Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Every month we talk with cellist Robert Cohen of the internationally acclaimed Fine Arts Quartet about music and about musicianship.
This month we'll pick up on a conversation that began in February. Robert, welcome back to Lake Effect. It is a pleasure to see you.
It's a pleasure to see you too, Bonnie.
We had such a great conversation last month about choosing and maintaining your instrument, particularly at the level that you play. But we left out something that I think is crucially important and most people don't think about unless they are players themselves, and that is the bow. And how you choose a bow and how many bows you have, because I know some string players have many, that depending on what they want to do. So does the bow come with the instrument, or is that a completely separate thing?
It's a completely separate thing, unless, I suppose, perhaps when you very, very first start, obviously, maybe you'll get a bow with your cello or your violin. But after that, they are a very separate thing, and they have an entire history of their own. There are Baroque bows, which are shaped differently for early music, and then there's the classical bow that I use and most classical musicians use, which was developed, I suppose, mostly in the late 1700s by François Tourte in France, who kind of changed the whole future of bows.
And this is for cellos specifically,
no,
or
this
in general?
With violins, cello bows, viola bows. He had a whole new principle. I mean, just one thing, for instance, bows had that bend in them, that curve in them. Well, previously, that was cut to be that shape. The piece of wood was cut to be that curve. But then Tourte decided to take a straight piece of wood and heat it and then bend it when it was hot to the shape it is. For some reason or other, that became absolutely the way that bows have been made ever since, because they sounded so amazing. And so this is really your question, really, isn't it? Why is it important? Is the bow something that makes any difference? And the answer is yes. Just as it's so difficult to find the right cello, it's incredibly difficult to find the right bow. Every single bow has a different character. And I suppose the way I think I can explain this, like I can explain about cellos, is that the people who made them are artists, and they're creating something, and they put themselves into that bit of wood, like they would a painting or carving a sculpture. And their whole character and their personality goes, their desire, their love goes into that object. And I think that cellos and bows hold that. They hold the character of their maker. It's not a mathematical thing. It's not a scientific thing. Nobody in all these hundreds of years has ever been able to explain why a great instrument sounds like it does. I mean, there have been so many scientific studies, and nobody can say. And I think, personally, it's because the talent, the genius, has gone into the wood, into the creation, and it remains there. And maybe it's something to do with the moment. So when you take a bow by François Tourte, why is one bow different from another bow? Because he felt different when he made them.
Yeah.
And if he was in a good mood or a bad mood, or he just fell in love with this bit of wood. I mean, this is the musician talking now. You see, when I see a piece of wood, I start thinking about it. When I see a cello or a bow, I look at the wood and I'm almost salivating. If it's really a beautiful piece of wood, I'm dreaming about what kind of sounds it can make and what it can do. And if I look at a piece of wood that's boring, I'm hardly interested in picking it up. But then I've learned that's not always exactly right. Sometimes bows have hidden qualities, and not always the beautiful wood is always the beautiful sound. It might be, but it might not be. So searching for bows, you know, I go to an instrument dealer and they might have 30 really, really beautiful cello bows from the early 1700s to modern bows. And what I'll do actually is I will lay them out on a table. I'll turn my back to the table. I'll take my cello. I'll reach around and I will play for perhaps 2 minutes on the bow. And then I will put it at the back of the pile and take the next one. Now, that's because I don't want to be influenced by the names of the great makers. There are many great makers who have made bows recognized to be really the most amazing bows. But it's important just to feel them and also to see how they work with your instrument, because the characters are so strong that they can really not get on with your cello. They can just argue, or they can just go beautifully together. And as we were talking about with the cellos, it's a question of what you personally are looking for. But having said that, sometimes you pick up a bow and before you've even played a note on it, you just have a sense. The way it moves in the air, the balance of it, the feel in your hand, you can start, like I said, you can start salivating already. You can already taste the sounds that you're going to be making with them. And it's, again, sometimes you just fall for a bow. You just think, this is just absolutely fabulous. But then they do have, like cellos, they have some limitations. They're very, very good at certain things, but not necessarily good at everything.
So do you have more than one bow in your arsenal of bows, depending on what you're playing?
Yes, because, for instance, when I play a concerto with orchestra, when I'm the soloist in front of 100 people, I need a bow that's incredibly good at projecting the sound, really punching out the strongest things. And I'm not as concerned necessarily with the absolute subtleties at the softest end. But if I take a bow to play string quartets with a fine arts quartet, I need something that has a way of molding the sound. It needs to fit with the other instruments. It needs also to stand out in its own way, but I don't need to trumpet my sound. So I need something that's more subtle in certain ways, not necessarily so strong. But then, and this is kind of quite typical, for instance, when we're in a rehearsal with a quartet, the violinists in the quartet, they have quite a number of bows which they carry in their case, and we'll be playing some Mozart or something, and then we'll switch to another piece, say Shostakovich, and they'll say, oh no, this doesn't work, no, this is no good, I've got to take another bow, this staccato, this short notes just don't sound the right way, I need a different bow. And of course it's amazing, because these are some of the greatest musicians in the world who can play any way they want. And they can make any kind of sound they want virtually with any bow. But at that moment, you'll suddenly get that feeling. They'll suddenly say, no, no, this is not right. I need a different kind of weight of bow. I need a different flexibility for this music.
Will you do that as well? Do you have different bows depending on the composer that you're performing? Or do you tend to stick with more like a concerto bow and a chamber music bow?
Well, I do tend to. I suppose I don't carry as many bows as they do.
Well, yours are bigger.
Well, maybe. Yeah. Maybe that's what it is. Also, there's very practical things because, you know, the bow hair, which is a horse hair, and it's taken from the tail of a horse. You know, there are about, 100 hairs on the bow. And as you play, they start to wear out. They get thinner and thinner and they start breaking. And then at some point or other, you have to have them replaced. Now, this is really nothing important in terms of the bow itself. And the bow can be this fantastic thing made in 1810 in Paris. And that's the historic part, the most important part. And the hair, which is replaced maybe every couple of months, that often if you're playing a lot. But it turns out, again, you have to find the right person to do it. And there are not so many people who can rehair a bow beautifully. They're just the right type of hair from the right place. It might be Siberian horse hair. It might be whatever it is. They might have a good batch or a bad batch. They need skill, real skill, to know how that particular bow handles and how many hairs it needs, the kind of tension it's going to take. So, again, finding somebody who suits your way, who can rehair your bow every couple of months, is not easy. And it's a dying art. The thing is that when you're rehearsing and practicing all the time, you're wearing these hairs out. So then you keep the best bows for the concerts, you know, because otherwise you're going to be in trouble. So for a practical reason, you just wait. But it's easy to make a mistake then because they feel different, they make the sound different, they respond differently.
And you haven't been practicing with them.
Precisely, Bonnie. And you have to be really careful. I've made mistakes sometimes. I wish I'd just taken my bow a few days earlier, just so that I was a bit more comfortable.
I think of the bow, it truly is an extension of your arm. It's an extension of your body.
Yeah.
And how you perform, and whether you're a violinist or a cellist, do you play overhand or underhand, or does it depend on the piece?
Always overhand.
Always, okay.
In classical world, the double bass players coming from certain countries use the bow from underneath.
And I've seen that in orchestras where you've got
the
big, and those bows are huge.
Absolutely, enormous, yeah. And that's the early way of using them, and I think, but there are bass players who also use the
overhand.
But all cellists and violinists of the classical era do it that way, whereas some Baroque players have a different bow holder, obviously a completely different bow, and it's used differently.
And a different instrument that they're playing on. Mm-hmm. And that's more the gamba. That, to me, I think of the gamba style, which is the underhand
on
the cello.
Precisely.
And a shorter, I think it's a shorter stroke.
Yeah, and also you'll see that it's curved away from the hair as opposed towards the hair. And that has a different way of lifting or sticking to the string. And so that's the way they used to do it until everything changed and the instruments were made differently. And the old instruments adapted, like my cello, which was made in 1723, was adapted by 1800, I would say, to withstand much greater tension, higher bridges, tougher strings, bows that started to put more pressure on in order really just simply to make more sound, to fill bigger concert halls, to fulfill the necessity of the music, which was cello concertos, which, you know, people want to hear cello as a soloist in front of an orchestra. And so the Baroque instruments played in a different way were just not suited to that.
No, they couldn't produce enough sound.
That's right.
Right. So I have to ask, how many bows are you working with at any given time?
I would say three.
Okay. It's less than I thought. I thought you were going to tell me a half a dozen or more.
Yeah, well, as I say, a lot of my violinist colleagues tend to have a lot more. I don't know why that is. Perhaps violinists are just a bit more crazy about these things.
They could be.
Yeah.
Well, as always, Robert, it is such a pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to On That Note again next month.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Lake Effect contributor Robert Cohen is an award-winning recording artist, conductor, artistic director, and cellist for the Fine Arts Quartet. He spoke with us as part of our regular monthly segment called On That Note with Robert Cohen.
It is March. Baseball players have reported to spring training, and the temperature is, at least theoretically, warming up. And before you know it, the snow might melt, and it will be time to get bulbs and plants into the ground. After the break, we'll travel to a garden center like no other. You might think that's hyperbole, but it is not. Mulch madness when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.